I'm kind of been following these new methane laws and just some new regulations coming into play. And I stumbled upon a story from a few months ago out of Florida where some independent producers, the leader of the organization was really becoming vocal. And then I stumbled upon a story about some stripper wells. And so I kind of put two and two together with these different methane rules and regulations. And somehow your name came out of that is what I believe it came from. Does any of that sound familiar?
Yeah, there's sort of two big framework elements here. One is a regulatory initiative that has been, you know, evolving since 2012 and is now about to release another round of regulations.
Okay.
And then there's also a methane tax issue is developing in the Congress as a part of the big reconciliation package.
Okay.
One of the dynamics, if you look at methane emissions in our country, they're about 9% of the total greenhouse gas inventory. They're divided roughly in thirds between petroleum and natural gas systems, agriculture, and then sort of a collection of smaller industry groupings, mostly landfills, where methane is generated as a part of the decay of material in the landfill. Regulatorily, big regulatory effort with respect to oil and gas, somewhat of a regulatory effort with respect to landfills, no regulatory effort with respect to agriculture. If you look at the congressional thing, we have a tax on methane from oil and gas operations, but nothing on anybody else. So it's, and we're about, so we're about a third of that 9%, roughly 3%. If you look at oil and gas production specifically, it's about a little over 1% of the greenhouse gas inventory. So, you know, we're really being aggressively targeted, both regulatorily and legislatively, and it will have an effect on our ability to produce oil and natural gas in the United States over time.
So a few of the things that I've written down in my notes is, you know, kind of when I was tracking the EPA rules and some of the regulatory things, it is very confusing. And so I appreciate you coming on here. And do you mind if I just go back a couple of years and we just I want to start in like, say, August 2020, where you guys publicly came out and commended the EPA and the new rules. Well, then in June, there was a reversal. And is that kind of what we're talking about now? Is that these rules kind of got rid of? Let's start in August 2020. What were the rules
Let's actually go back to, let me go back farther than that.
Okay,
so the rules that have been the federal rules, let me also understand that the regulation of air emissions is a mix of federal activity and state activity. And states are the primary regulators. Even the Clean Air Act, even though it's a federal law, it's basically structured with the idea that the federal government will create sort of national overriding regulatory structure, but the day-to-day regulation will be delegated to states. Additionally, states can act on their own. They have their own organic Clean Air Acts. They have the authority given to them by their state legislature, and so they do regulations as well.
And I'd like to just interject real quick because I'm in North Dakota, and we're one of those states that does do that. We've gotten an A+ air rating from, you know, the different organizations for pretty much my entire journalistic career. And Wayne Stengem, our attorney general, has sued the federal government many times on behalf of this. And I believe technically, you know, if you boil it down, we've got kind of a voluntary state-run kind of a regulatory deal when it comes to that. And I think Texas is another one that falls under that as well. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. And Colorado and Oklahoma and New Mexico and California, they all have their own structures. Now, some of them, this gets even more convoluted, some of them regulate methane directly. Some of them regulate volatile organic compounds because that's been a historic component of the Clean Air Act.
What would be an example of a volatile organic compound?
Hexane, heptane, propane. Basically, it's anything that can be a part of like a crude oil or natural gas that, becomes vapor in atmospheric conditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anything that can become a vapor. It really got regulated mostly because those, with the exception of methane, those compounds are the ones that are precursors to forming smog or ozone when they enter, when they react with nitrogen oxides. So that's the, so the history of regulating hydrocarbons is largely wrapped around dealing with ozone and trying to stop smog from forming. What happened, however, in the early 2000s or late 1990s, the courts ruled that greenhouse gases could be considered pollutants under the Clean Air Act. And so that brought in methane as a potential direct regulated emission. And so we've had this tension then back and forth since then over regulation structures, whether they're going to be VOC or whether they're going to be methane. For my part of the industry, for production, it really makes no difference because they are emitted together and they are managed together. So if you're capturing your propane or your butane, you're also going to be capturing or managing your methane, and vice versa. If you're going after methane, you're going to get all these other VOCs as well. So, but it plays out differently within the structure of the Clean Air Act some, and that's been one of the tensions that particularly showed up when you get to your August 2020 point in time. That's one of the issues that showed up there. So if you look over the past decade, what you've seen is the federal government, partly being pushed by initially by litigation, starting to create new source performance standards for the oil and gas industry, and particularly the production component of it. That played out first with regulations in 2012 that really hit the biggest emitting components, storage vessels, pneumatic controllers, and then what's reduced emissions completions from fractured natural gas wells. Those are where the largest emissions pieces of our industry tend to fall. In 2016, the Obama administration put out a second set of new source performance standards, and it dealt with pneumatic pumps. It dealt with reduced emission completions from oil wells. But the new thing it really added, which has been one of the more contentious components, is a fugitive emissions program. And the reason it's been more contentious is that our industry, and you probably know this from your North Dakota perspective, is very diverse. We have big companies, we have little companies. We have big wells, we have little wells. The economics between them are very different, and their ability to absorb regulatory costs are very different. When EPA proposed its 2016 rule for fugitive emissions, it applied it only to large wells. But when it finalized it under pressure from the environmental lobby, it expanded it to all wells, but it never went back and changed the structure of the regulation to reflect that what might work for large wells is not cost-effective for small wells. The other thing that those rules did was change the regulated emission from VOC, which it had been in 2012, to methane. The impact of that is that under the structure of the Clean Air Act, if you're regulating methane because it's not a particular type of pollutant called criteria or hazardous, then that action of regulating as a new source performance standard then triggers a nationwide existing source emission guideline requirement, so that not only was that decision to regulate methane affecting the new sources, but it created this task of grappling with existing sources. And the part of the rule that part of the law that deals with that was really written to cover situations where you had a pollutant that had very few sources when you were regulating it as a new source and very few existing sources. But when you get into oil and gas, you're dealing with a million existing oil and gas wells. And so it has a very, very different task for EPA to grapple with and for the states to grapple with when you continue to regulate methane. The 2020 rule that you started talking about is there were two rules. One of them was a technical revision to the new source performance standard, which was trying to grapple with issues that weren't, robust enough or fully understood enough when the rule was initiated, that needed to be addressed and improved in the course of the changes to it. And among those things was some interpretation of how to regulate storage vessels, which really went back to the 2012 rule, some issues about the technology that EPA had embraced for its fugitive program, which really was taking a very expensive and sort of older technology and newer technologies that were coming along that were faster, cheaper, more cost effective, weren't really going to be usable under that rule. And that was kind of counterproductive, if you will, for trying to have good regulation. And then the third piece of it was dealing with treatment of low production well sites, where EPA chose to then exclude those low production, exclude sites when they became low production wells, less than 15 barrels a day is a criteria. So that was, and then the second rule was a rule to shift the regulated target from methane back to VOC. So that now sets the stage as 2021 begins. In 2021, we've got two events going on. One is Biden administration comes in and says, we are going to go back and revisit those 2020 rules. We're going to change the regulated pollutant back to methane. We're going to make the rules tougher. We're going to put out some additional rules. And when we do that, we're also going to go after the existing sources. Secondly, Congress steps in at that point in time and passes what's called a Congressional Review Act provision that mandates, if you will, that methane has to be the regulated emission. It repeals that second rule that changed the regulated target. So that's done at the same time. They were going to do that regulatorily, but Congress steps in and initiates that effort as well. So now where we are is that we're now dealing with a methane-based regulatory structure, and two rulemakings have stepped into the interagency review process. They've now been drafted by EPA. They're now going through interagency review, and then they will be proposed most likely around the end of this month, we think. Maybe it may drag into early November. There's a international meeting on global climate and methane, particularly, that the administration wants to show it's going to be a tough methane regulator. So those two rules are, one, a revision to the new source performance standards again, that will go back and look at those August 2020 rules and make changes to them, and may expand the scope of the rules. There's some other areas that the EPA is looking at expanding into regulation of, like flaring and liquid unloading, which is a really obscure part of the operations of oil and gas. And then the second piece of it will be emissions guidelines for existing sources. And those are not direct federal regulations, initially at least. They are guideline model regulatory structures for states to adopt. And if the states don't adopt them, then the federal government can come in and create its own plan. But then it has to be the regulator, which is always difficult because EPA isn't staffed to do day-to-day regulation. So that's a long answer. Maybe too long. You probably want to go back and talk about some pieces of it.
Well, I did want to mention that, you know, the reversal of these rules have created like a literal whiplash impact on the oil and gas industry. And I wanted to throw some numbers that our research has turned up to just get your comments on them, if they're accurate, if they're not accurate, if there's something in the ballpark that, you know, it's this instead. And the first one is that number you brought up of 15 barrels per day that produce less than 15 barrels a day, that benchmark rule number, we did find that, and there's something of 770,000 wells that produce less than 15 barrels a day, and that impacts about 15,000 businesses. Are those numbers accurate?
Yeah. It's because and to just add to that, that's what the threshold is. Okay, 15 barrels a day. But if you look at the average crude oil well that falls into that category of low production wells produces around 2.5 barrels a day. And the average gas well, where the threshold would be 90 MCF a day, corresponding to the 15 barrels a day, that produces, the average gas well, low production gas well, produces around 22 to 24 MCF a day. So even though that's the threshold, the actual production level is much smaller. And so therefore the burden can be even higher. Probably the 10 to 15,000 number of companies is about right. It's difficult to judge. We tend to put it in that range. Those might have been IPAA numbers, actually.
You know, I'm not. I might be right. Actually, they are. Well, and I rounded up with the 15,000, I think, as well. As far as mineral owners, I don't know if your study or other studies know the number of mineral owners that this would impact, but my guess would be those people that, you know, rely on some mailbox money from time to time. I know people, at least in North Dakota, that rely on that for their income. You know, we're not talking about, you know, sheiks going out and buying new yachts here. We're talking about, I think the average mineral owner is like a 65-year-old woman in the Bakken.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And it's I want to say the number is in the 12 million range over nationwide. But I'm not, in each state you can get the.
Well, we can round down. We'll say 10 million. How's that?
Yeah, the National Association of Royalty Owners can give you a state by state breakout, but I can't tell you what North Dakota is. I need to put a point on this because it's hard to say what exactly the impact is going to be yet. For these reasons, one, these are going to be emissions guidelines. We haven't seen them. We don't know what they're going to try to make them do on existing sources. we're very concerned about it because we know that the technology that they've used for big wells is just, it's way too costly for little wells. And if they use the same technology, that would be, that could be devastating. In fact, if you look at EPA's own actions, after they did the new source performance standard in 2016, they then did what was called a control technique guideline, sort of the same kind of concept as these emissions guidelines, that's a part of the ozone non-attainment program, regulatory program. And in that guideline, while they required the same kind of fugitive emissions program for big wells, they specifically excluded low production wells in giving guidelines to states for them to regulate under their ozone regulation for existing sources for VOC. So their past history on this is very inconsistent with respect to low production wells. Secondly, these guidelines should provide under the structure of the guideline rules subcategorization of operations, and this is an industry where subcategorization is almost by definition the way the industry works. You have crude oil wells, you have natural gas wells, you have crude oil wells with associated gas, you have natural gas wells with associated liquids. So, you know, each of those has a different emissions profile because of the nature of their operation. You have 15 barrel a day cutoff, but you have 2 barrels of average production. And many, many wells are less than that, obviously, that's the average. And the average is going to be skewed towards the bigger wells as they're declining from 15 down to 10, down to 5, down to 2.5, down to 1. So you should see a substantial subcategorization in these emissions guidelines to reflect those different characteristics of the industry. There is, in fact, a DOE study, Department of Energy study, right now that should be finished in December that's looking at that exact issue. What's the emissions profile for these low production wells? What's unfortunate is that EPA seems to be moving on the regulatory package before it gets the results of that study. So that's not a good sign. That's not a good practice for the agency, which is talking about how it wants to use good science and regulation to come out with this package before they get the data from this Department of Energy study that tells them what the profile will look like. The next factor is that these ultimately go to the states, and states have a flexibility, including in law, the flexibility to make decisions about the regulation of these existing sources based on their remaining existing life, either by facility or by category. So how this will play out over the next several years, once these guidelines are put in place, can really influence what the ultimate impact will be on existing wells. And a part of our objective is to give them the federal rule as much flexibility for the states to be able to grapple with those distinctions as possible.
One of the things we were talking about in 2015 and 16 was when I would come back from Colorado. I usually stayed in Fort Collins, and I would go to Greeley in Denver for my meetings in Fort Collins, a nice place. And generally, because Horsetooth Reservoir was right there, so I could go do my mountainous stuff with a 5-minute drive. Anyway, that's his little sidebar there. But I was noticing in the breakfast bars, because I'd stay in places where I'd go eat down in the breakfast bars and talk with the common folk, you know? That's how I get to know my journalism stories, you know, what people are talking about. Well, when the oil and gas industry folk were there, I noticed, and primarily in women, they would look over their shoulder before they would say that they worked in oil and gas.
Yeah.
And I started asking, like, one time, finally, after the fourth or fifth time, I said, why did you look over your shoulder? I've noticed people have been doing that. And she said, well, it's kind of getting a bad rap here in Colorado. So we started talking about that a little bit and started asking around. And I started flat out saying that, boy, this reminds me of the smoking ban, about the same template of public health and the way that they're using emotion over fact and attitude over information. And sure enough, I saw what happened to Colorado. Yep. And then earlier in our conversation, when you were mentioning some of those, just the history of the methane laws coming out of, you know, the early or the late 90s, early 2000s, I thought, boy, that sounded like my time in Huntington Beach and going to school at Fullerton, man. That's some California regulatory talk there. So I almost started wondering, did this start in California and then Colorado kind of, you know, came to the next chapter of it? And, you know, what are your comments on the smoking ban template, too, in terms of a comparison? I know it's a loaded question, but yeah. I think you kind of understand it, though.
Yeah, no, it's so let's see how to frame up a good
answer. How about this? Let's start in California. Did a lot of this come out of California from the 90s?
If you kind of look at the history of this industry and its regulatory structure, particularly in the Clean Air Act, most of the history of it was, as I said, related to ozone. Ozone tends to be an urban issue.
Sure.
It's cars, concentrated industry. And the oil and gas industry was generally rural and very scattered. I mean, wells were, you know, 10 acres apart. Before you had horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, you know, you basically were drilling vertical wells, so you had to be right on top of your formations. And your formations were what we call conventional formations, which, you know, are kind of spread out over wide areas and pockets. And then as we get into the shale, it really changes that, and it changes the nature of the way you go about doing it. You can drill one well. You can turn it horizontally. You can drill through a whole bunch of shale for miles if you want to. so you tend to concentrate the facility in one space, and it looks much more like the newer wells will probably have 20 well bores on one big pad area with tanks to store the crude and etc.
By the way, just to interrupt, that's an amazing feat, and more examples of decarbonization happening on its own, but go ahead. Sorry.
Absolutely. for years, because we were really on the on this diverse rural framework, very little clean air attention went to the industry. There was some related to benzene emissions from hazardous air emissions from benzene and certain dehydrators. And if you were in an urban area, you might get quite a bit of attention, but most of the air emissions are small, and most of them were not affecting ozone in any particular area. So as we see the shale boom start, the sidebar to that is we now start getting much more visible. And the second dynamic was that if you looked at our history from 1970 until whatever, about 2010, we were declining in oil production. We were declining in natural gas production. We weren't going to be a major threat going forward, but shale changes that. If you look at the debate over natural gas, if you go back to the mid 90s and on into the mid early 2000s, natural gas was viewed as the alternative to the evil coal. You wanted to get rid of coal and use natural gas. Well, the environmentalists at that point in time viewed natural gas as a bridge fuel. It was only going to be there for a short period of time. But shale made it a superhighway. You were going to have gas for as long as you could see. And so the threat that poses to the environmentalists that want to eliminate fossil fuel elevates substantially. And so first what you saw was their effort to go after hydraulic fracturing. So it was fracturing is bad. Fracturing isn't regulated. We don't know what's happening with fracturing. And so there was a huge effort to try to suppress fracturing as a technology. That didn't really work. But then the climate issue arises, and now you start seeing it being the focal point. Methane is the bad actor. Methane is worse than coal, in their view. So you want to get rid of methane. You want to get, and how you do that? Well, you get rid of oil and gas drilling. So if you look at the states at this point in time, California is probably out ahead of most states, not particularly because it was such a leader on the climate issues associated with the industry, but because it had been heavily regulating its oil and gas production for ozone purposes for a long time. And in the course of doing that, it started developing leak detection and repair or fugitive emissions programs ahead of most of the other states. For the past 5 or 6 years, for the past 8 years, you've seen a much higher increase in states getting engaged in dealing with air emissions, methane emissions, VOC emissions. And the characteristic of the state is sort of defined how it goes about doing it. For the 4 years of the Trump administration, because they didn't see the federal government as the tough regulator that they had been building in the Obama administration, there was a significant shift to try to get the states to really step up. And Colorado was one of them. New Mexico is parroting Colorado in large measure. Other states, not so much. Texas, North Dakota, Oklahoma have regulatory programs that deal with their existing sources, but they're more flexible. They're less focused on trying to go after methane per se, but they are requiring on both, and also the fact that we're a turnover industry. We're constantly turning over the pool of facilities. As new sources adopt these new technologies, then they become existing sources. And in fact, if you go back to your earlier example, if you look at this existing source issue, by the time these rules get out, essentially those 770,000 wells are going to be the only ones that are not under one or both of the new source performance standards, because the 2012 standard's been in place now for 10 years and roughly 10 years. And so all of those wells, all the tanks that were built for those wells now have vapor recovery on them. And that's really where your biggest emission is. So you're cutting a huge chunk of emissions there. But you have seen the states here in the last 4 years getting more visible and more active. Now you've got the Biden administration. The environmentalists always want to come back and mandate things at the federal level, because then they can go to federal court, and that federal rule has to be obeyed by all the states. So the tougher you can make it, the less flexibility the states have to distinguish between their operations and the state next to them, if they want to.
Yeah, it's interesting when you say the ozone, versus like the air and environment, because I never thought of it like that, because you're exactly right. It's almost like an urban and rural terminology and look at it, because in a lot of the Texas and North Dakota and these states, it is rural. And so you do not have what I saw in California. I've commended California on their just the work that they did with reducing whatever emissions or smog, because when I lived out there, you couldn't even see the Santa Monica. I mean, the mountain from the Santa Monica Expressway. But that was, that was a collective effort by putting caps on the gas pumps, and then you've got new emissions and engines and et cetera, et cetera. So I saw how, collectively, a community can do things along those lines. I guess I never looked at it from a oil and gas regulatory. That was just a more of a common sense movement that solved the problem collectively.
And most of the focus at that time would be on refining.
Sure.
And because that's where your big VOC emitters. See, the ozone precursor aspect of VOCs is much stronger in those heavier VOCs. Methane is largely was never considered a VOC for ozone purposes until the last year or two. And even now, it's a very, very, very minimal ozone precursor. Its focus is all climate. And so, that's why you saw so much of that intensity on hydrocarbon emissions, cars, gasoline refueling, refinery operations, chemical plants. I grew up in the Houston area, so we were like right behind California in terms of the pressure to deal with ozone.
And again, that was something I repeated several times. You know, it was a collective effort because it's more than one. And what I'm seeing as a trend, especially when it comes to the environment, so many lawyers and politicians are setting policy on a singular issue without having any regard for the unintended, or maybe they are intended, consequences that come along with it. Is that ever discussed? I mean, where is these studies coming from? Is there more than one, or is it just one study that is making these rural reversals and et cetera?
Oh, the environmentalists churn out studies on a regular basis. There's probably, and they're basically pointed towards whatever outcome they want to pursue. I've spent a good deal of time digging into those studies, because so frequently, as the politics of this debate since 2016 has been actively related to trying to tar low production wells as a principal cause of the methane pool of emissions in the country. And it doesn't hold water very well because they're just too small. Now, if there's a tank at an old existing well, it's going to have some emissions. And because it's not under the 2012 rule, those are not subject to vapor recovery. Now, gradually they'll turn over, but they're not that big either. I mean, even the threshold for vapor recovery is something like 4 tons a year, I think, of emissions. And these, little wells, you're not actually filling them like every day. A lot of these small wells, they'll open them up and pump them for, a day, and then wait for the oil to refill the well bore, pump them again. And so they'll, go into these tank batteries or tanks and fill. And as you fill, you're going to push vapor out. And the longer it sits there, the more vapor you'll have. One of the big problems we run into is there are what they call thief hatches on these storage tanks. And they're a hatch that you open up so you can plumb the tank to find out what the liquid level is. People don't close the thief hatches. So then they create, just an emissions point. That didn't take a FLIR camera, which is this infrared camera that's a part of this leak detection program, to figure out that you need to close the thief hatch. And if you look at these studies that the environmentalists do, what you find is where there are emissions from low production wells, it's almost inevitably from something like a tank, or somebody, a tree has fallen on a pipe or something like that. They're not leaks coming out of the valves and the flanges. There's just not that much flow going through there to push the leaks out from those kind of pieces of equipment, which is what this LDAR program, fugitive emissions programs, I tend to use these things. LDAR is leak detection and repair. I tend to use that interchangeably, but they're presuming you're going to have leaks from pieces of equipment during its operation. Whereas I think if you go to low production wells, what you'll find is if you're going to have emissions, they're probably coming from vents on places like tanks and maybe some vessels if they have them there. But they're just not that big. But we have had to go through study after study after study because EPA back when it made its decision to capture low production wells in the 2016 rule, based it on one study that some environmentalists did where they really contorted the statistical analysis to come up with a rationale that suggests that these little wells were super emitters. And now these studies come out pretty regularly. Now they're doing, you know, satellite stuff and flyover stuff and helicopters with cameras and drones with cameras to try to target these little wells. And we're having to regularly try to refute that.
What's the states at? Petroleum alliances, the councils, the organizations, they all got different names. But at the end of the day, each state generally has some sort of oil and gas representation. Are they involved by being a voice for this, or is this not at the register yet?
They're quite active. We've operated an independent producer coalition that includes a great number of the state trade associations, like the North Dakota Petroleum Council, for example. They're active and they're very worried about the impact on their small producers, because they're small businesses, they're small wells. But correspondingly, as you might guess, everybody in this industry is cash strapped after the last year or so.
One of the reasons why I bring it up is because, you know, when I started hearing the word drones and, you know, that sort of regulation, that's expensive. And, you know, the bigger companies, they can absorb that. In fact, a lot of them have gotten even government grants to get this equipment years ago. And then all of a sudden now, if the young person and the, you know, independent small company, the small, you know, that's tough. That's a tough expense to absorb.
So the challenge in this has been not whether you regulate, but how. I mean, everybody understands in the industry that we have air emissions and the air emissions need to be managed. So the first question is, well, how big are the air emissions for different types of operations? And they're obviously much larger for a big 20-well hydraulically fractured gas pad than they are for a one-well low-production well someplace in Pennsylvania that produces 6 MCF a day, let's say. Okay. So the question is, where do the emissions come from for the different types of facilities? And what are the most cost-effective ways to grapple with those emissions? Some of them are going to be that you don't, in our view, need to have the expensive analytical method that's in the new source performance standard, which is an optical gas imaging infrared camera that you take out twice a year to judge what the risk of emissions might be at little, small producing wells. If you understand what the framework of those emissions are, then you can design things that are designed to make sure you minimize those emissions, like soap bubbles. You can put soap bubbles on your equipment and see whether it's bubbling. Is there something coming out of there? Maybe the flanges need to be tightened a little bit here. But you don't necessarily need a FLIR camera. The other dynamic is that the nature of the emissions from this industry tend to be what they call fat tails. And that is that 85, even 90% of your equipment is emitting nothing. Okay? But some pieces have failed somehow, and they are emitting something. And some of them are emitting quite a bit. Okay, so the question is, how do you find those? What are those most likely to be? And get a sound, sensible way to manage them, which for a big operation or an operation that has multiple sites across a fairly wide basin, it might be better to fly a drone across it with a sensor that picks up hot spots and can say, okay, that well over there has a big emission. Why? Are we doing a liquid unloading there today? Are we doing some maintenance there today? Or do we have a leak we need to fix? And then you can go fix that. But the rules don't allow you to do that. You could do it, but you still have to do the regular rule anyway, which is use the FLIR camera. For little wells, it's probably more likely that what you're going to find out is that the emissions are going to take place in some sort of a vessel where you have a liquid stream that comes in, or gas stream, and it can release vapor when the pressure drops as it goes in there. And then, is there a leak or event that you need to manage? Some of those are safety events. They have to be there. Okay. You can't overpressure the equipment, right? Or you risk explosions and fires. So you have to have certain kinds of devices to protect the equipment. But others, like thief hatches, are a matter of making sure you close the thing, making sure the seals are sound when you close it, that there's not a big gap between the thief hatch and the tank. Those are all things that can be done without having to have an expensive fugitive emissions program. And so we're trying to work with the agency to make those points that these are not big sources to start with, and there are ways you can manage them that differ from what you would do with big sources, and do it in a way that doesn't threaten their economic viability. But that's the kind of the tone of the debate. Now, for the one of the things for the existing source issue, which is where the largest impact will ultimately be, is the fact that it does go back to the states, gives the state the opportunity to look at ways to manage its different emissions structures and size of facilities and things like that when it looks at what kind of a rulemaking it should do, and to take into account things like whether this cost would be so burdensome that it would just force the shutdown of that piece of equipment.
Lee Fuller with the Independent Petroleum Association of America. I appreciate the time. I have just kind of one more question as we wind down. I'm looking at the clock here, and I appreciate the time and access you've given us here today. Are you getting involved with this ESG movement? Is it even reached you at this point, that those terms yet, those letters?
Oh, yeah.
This ESG movement is involved with this?
Well, I think where you see the ESG movement mostly is going to be on larger publicly traded companies, or companies that are looking to raise capital, private capital or public capital, because the pressure there is coming mostly through the financial pathway, putting companies in a position to have to demonstrate their bona fide interest in protecting the environment and what they're doing to do that. And what it generates, particularly among the larger companies, is more of a voluntary program to go beyond the regulatory structure. So, for example, the new source performance standard has a start date, and the start date for the 2012 rule was late 2011. Any new or modified facility after that time had to have low bleed pneumatic controllers, so that that's an emissions point that needed to be regulated. Well, for a lot of big companies they'd been putting in low bleed controllers voluntarily before that, and they went back, and a lot of them put more in, or zero bleed, maybe go to a solar powered controller. We can get into the nuances of what's happening in the controller if you want, but they've done that, and then they profile that activity as a way to show that they're responsive to the environmental part of the ESG pressures. So yeah, it's having a big effect. It's more large company focused, because they're the ones that are more visible in a public arenas, whether it's through capital or their stock report, their SEC reports and other things that they have to do. But one of the challenges with ESG is that there's no single structure that people operate in. There's like three, maybe four different ways these financial groups have been analyzing ESG. And so if you're a company, you're faced with, do I have to do all of them? Is there some way to make this more consistent so we all operate under the same rules? American Petroleum Institute, I think, has been developing, trying to come up with a standardized way of assessing ESG, particularly the environmental pieces of it, so that everybody operates on the same with the same rules and in the same way, and so you're not just being whipsawed around by whichever source of the ESG is driving your particular analysis.
That's the first I've heard of that. We've been doing ESG now for about 6 years. We have Davis Refinery up here in the Bakken, the first greenfield refinery to be built in the U.S. And we ended up doing a weekly update with the CEO and the engineers and the project managers. And so we kind of backdoored into a weekly ESG update because that's all we did was a transparent update of who we were talking to and what bends were done in which pipes for this reason and all kinds of different things. And so I'm glad to hear, because what we've been trying to talk about, I speak on ESG at conferences, and one of my main messages in Gillette, Wyoming on September 1st was, you got to grab a hold of the narrative now, because what's happening is, we describe it like this, that the ESG economy is on the one-yard line with 99 yards to go, but we're in the first quarter, and the refs haven't even brought the ball or the rules out yet, except energy companies and economies and countries are already being impacted, so the game's begun. And that's what's difficult about this, is because you can go online and there's ESG scores on Yahoo Finance. So who came up with that, and how's that even being out there? And anyway, so that's good to hear that there is some narrative being captured, I guess, because I think the horse is out of the barn on this, and the best way for the energy industry to do this is get a hold of the narrative.
Well, in many respects, the environmental piece of it may be the most straightforward to grapple with. It's when you get into the social and governance aspects that you're really starting to tread ground in places where businesses haven't, really been inclined to be transparent about the way they make their decisions. And so they're very susceptible to being arbitrarily challenged about whatever they chose to do.
That's interesting you say that. We took a question after the Gillette, Wyoming session, and I said, in my opinion, the environmental, that's the easiest that the oil companies will be able to show. I said, they've been doing it for 150 years and they'll keep doing it. I said, the social, they're about half there. I said, they just need to actually probably be a little more vocal about some of the social they're doing, because they do quite a bit. Yeah. And then I said that the governance, that's going to be the sticky point, I said, for a variety of reasons. One is intellectual property. Number two is strategic shareholders, et cetera, I said. But number three is probably there's a little post-traumatic stress disorder, because about every 20 years there's a major accident and they never let go of the media. They never let go of it. You know, I mean, I come from ag. There's a lot of looking the other way in ag, a lot. So when I saw the what little impacts, like from that side, the oil and gas industry was having compared to, like, say, an ag community. A lot of people don't know ag was like the most dangerous profession for a long time. But nobody wanted to talk about it because you can't. And so it's just, and so go ahead.
Even now, and on environmental laws generally, Congress doesn't like to get into regulating agriculture directly.
No.
It doesn't know what to do. I mean, this whole methane issue, agriculture globally is probably the largest source of methane emissions. In the United States, it is actually the largest source of methane emissions in the United States, but it's roughly equivalent to oil and gas and the other groups. But, you know, what are you going to do? Shoot your cows? I mean, you know, stop growing rice? It's you know, very, very difficult to figure out any kind of structural regulatory scheme, but then to try to figure out how you're going to run that through the regulatory process. Is it going to be all federal? Is it going to be, you know, what? What's it going to look like? Who knows?
And that's one of the things that we should really take away from this is that, you know, the ozone versus air, the urban versus rural, the federal versus state. It's really difficult to take a complex issue like the environment and do a one-stop shop for everything.
Oh, yeah.
And
right.
What's next for the oil and gas industry? You know, what are you recommending for people that they do going into 2022 as we conclude here?
Well, we're urging people to, one, stay engaged, to educate the best they can on the nature of what they do and the nature of their operations. We're trying to get as much accurate information as we can into the discussion. But part of the dynamic that's been difficult and really from EPA's perspective is EPA has been pushed into what's now a decade-long regulatory cycle without ever having the opportunity to learn the industry in a non-intense, give me an answer to this question now type of approach. So the first rules were triggered by a court case and a consent decree. Fortunately, they were able to take on-the-shelf technologies and basically make those mandatory. There's always problems when you do that, but basically it was a framework that existed. But now they're being pushed into the realm in which there's not a clear technology, but they still don't have, you know, the opportunity to really grasp the nuances and the complexity of this very, very diverse industry. So a lot of it's trying to get our guys to, you know, stay in the game, educate. But they're under such financial stress that's difficult for them to do.
You have a website or any sort of a collective place people should go for more information?
Well, obviously there's the IPAA has its website, www.ipaa.org, IPAA.org. We also run a website called Energy in Depth, which is much more of a active responder type website to these issues as they come up, where, you know, allegations are raised and we rebut them. But we also provide a lot of information about the industry as well. So that would be another place to go.